So I guess while we're waiting, my name is Deepali Patel, and I work with the Institute of Medicine. And I have to apologize. I'm actually getting over a really bad illness. So if I seem a little bit out of focus or not quite present here, that's probably why. I feel free to like punch my arm and start drifting off or something. It was kind of a crazy weekend. So I'm a program officer with the Institute of Medicine, and for those of you not familiar with the Institute of Medicine, we fall under the umbrella of the National Academy of Sciences, and every country has some type of Academy of Science, which is an honorific institution. So it's made up of a bunch of members across the country and some places around the world who are the experts in their field, and they're voted and appointed by other members. And here, the National Academy of Science has been around for about 150 years. The Institute of Medicine is the health and medicine arm of the National Academies of Science, and it was established in 1970, so it's much newer. I'm not sure why we're not called the Academy of Medicine. I don't know why we're the Institute of Medicine, but the other science academies are all academies. That's sort of the 150-year-old question, I guess. So within the IOM, we do focus on all of the health and medicine aspects of evidence-based science, prevention, and research. Okay, great. I think I'm supposed to read my disclosure, of which I have no relationships to disclose. So, like I said, this is the IOM. We are independent, we're nonprofit, we're non-governmental. Most of our funding does come from government agencies, but a lot of it also comes from foundations, public, other parts of the public sector, private sector, et cetera. Health arm of the National Academy of Sciences established in 1970. So we do a number of things at the Institute of Medicine and at the National Academy of Sciences. The one thing that most people are probably most familiar with would be our consensus studies. Our consensus studies do set policy for the nation and sometimes globally as well. So amongst the things that our consensus studies have looked at, including patient errors, we set the DRIs for USDA and the FDA. We've been looking at a lot of the healthcare reform work, some of the Medicare, Medicaid issues that have been coming up, Social Security, et cetera. So the other thing that we do, which is a smaller portion of our work, is kind of falls under this nice heading of fostering discussion and discovery. And the idea is that sometimes you have topics that don't lend themselves to a really easy 18-month consensus study where you can just produce some conclusions and recommendations. Sometimes what you need to do is bring people together around a table, people who may not normally talk to each other in their sort of everyday work, even though they're working on similar issues. So what we do is we act as that convening mechanism, and we have this sort of really unique position of being both familiar with how the government works, but also open to including the private sector and academia as well. So we have a couple different types of convening activities. These are just some examples. And the one I'm going to talk about today is the Forum on Global Violence Prevention. So not to be confused with our Family Violence Prevention Forum here. We all happen to use the same words for everything. But at the IOM, a forum is this convening activity that brings together these various stakeholders. It's kind of a similar idea. So like I said, we bring together these various leaders, government, industry, academia, et cetera. We do provide this neutral, impartial setting. And we do focus on evidence-based practice, whether it's, you know, in the research end of it or the actual implementation side or evaluation or whatever it is. One of the things we really like to do is for topics that don't tend to get a lot of widespread publicity, we like to bring people together in this area and kind of talk about how a certain issue may be affecting different sectors. And people often don't think about, for example, with violence, people would often think about how violence can really affect every sector out there. And one of the things we try to do is bring people together to talk about, okay, you work in the tourism industry, you own a major hotel chain, have you thought about what this problem of violence is doing for your bottom line, but also, you know, caring for your employees and your families and your clients and, you know, et cetera. So kind of the main focus of the Forum on Global Violence Prevention, its goals and the mission, completely based around this idea that violence is preventable, which I think is something that is still not very well understood outside of people who work in the field. We talk about this a lot with people in other sectors, and you know, you kind of push up against this wall of people saying, it's inevitable, it's going to happen, it's always been happening, what are we going to do about it? And I think this sort of paradigm shift has only been happening in the last couple decades. We also believe that there's a lot of, you know, different types of violence, that there's some common underpinnings of all these different types of violence. So family violence, you know, incorporates a lot of different types of violence. There's violence against children, there's violence against intimate partners, there's violence against elders, et cetera. And there are commonalities between these different types of violence, and there's even some intersections and co-occurrence of these different types of violence. We're really interested in catalyzing this investment in evidence-based prevention work. So making the case to the donors, for example, that investing in early prevention is very important. It's not just trying to deal with the problem after the fact, but what is it that you can do to strengthen individuals, communities, neighborhoods, societies, et cetera, to prevent violence. And then, most importantly, improving this collaboration and multi-sectoral integration of violence into health and social development. So it's not that violence prevention sits in this little silo separate from everything else, but that it is a really important piece of everything else we're trying to do out there. So we will not, you know, meet our Millennium Development Goals if we can't address these problems of violence, whether they're at the micro level within families or at this much larger level, including conflict. So just really briefly, the membership of our forum, we have 29 members. You can see they're from all over the place, some potentially controversial. But what we are really trying to do is bring together everybody around the table, everybody who has a stake in this issue, whether they can prevent it, whether they cause it, you know, or whether they're just affected by it, all of these people around the table. And this is the membership. So what we do is convene the members to kind of discuss where they want to go with the forum. And one of the things they do is they host these public workshops. And so this first workshop was on preventing violence against women and children. And this workshop was held just this past January. And what we did was we brought speakers from around the world together here in D.C., and we held this workshop. It's right down the street, I think, actually, like three blocks away. And had speakers present on various aspects of their, you know, whatever their work was. And we had people, we had the chief public health officer from the government of Canada, which is sort of similar to our Surgeon General. And, you know, he's not a violence prevention expert, but he got up there and was really clearly able to express why they care about violence prevention in Canada, why this is an important issue in the Ministry of Health, in the public health agency. And we had a couple other people, Lynn Rosenthal, who is in the Joe Biden's office at the White House, to talk about, you know, the Violence Against Women Act and what that's meant over the years and how this has improved family violence prevention. And, you know, brought this greater attention to these issues. We had some people come and talk about these co-occurrences of violence between within families. So, you know, parents, mothers who are being abused by their partners, and maybe one or the other parent is more likely to then inflict violence on children, et cetera. And how are there ways to prevent these co-occurrences? And then we talked a little bit about trauma, too. So, you want to, you know, prevent violence before it starts, but at the same time, you want to prevent the reoccurrence of violence. And so is there a relationship between the trauma that people experience post-violence and potential future perpetration of violence? So out of this workshop, we kind of found four big themes emerged. And these are the four themes around which our future work will revolve. The first is violence against women and children is common, universal, and intertwined. these co-occurrences require addressing both of these issues simultaneously, that living in these silos of child maltreatment and violence against women or intimate partner violence is not going to get us much more forward than we already are. So bringing these fields together and these practitioners together is really important. And the intergenerational transmission of violence has impact beyond the family. So it isn't just that sometimes you have a child who is a victim of child maltreatment who then grows up to be a perpetrator. You have this, you start to see this sort of move outside of the family and into the extended family or the neighborhood or the community. It affects children's work in school. It affects parents' work, you know, in the workplace, et cetera. So it isn't, these are not just issues isolated to, victims, for example. The second is that paradigms and social norms can change. So I mentioned this is global, so we did look at issues all around the world. And one of the things we kind of noticed is that everyone talks about gender equality. A number of people who talk about gender equality never talk about violence. And so you cannot achieve gender equality without addressing this issue of violence against women or children, because a large number of the survivors of child maltreatment are girls or women. And that the solutions to other health inequities must address violence. So, you know, we talk a lot about conflict resolution, maternal and child health, nutrition, et cetera, and all of this is very intricately tied with violence and violence prevention. So without introducing or including this idea of violence prevention, these solutions will not be as successful. Knowledge transforms to action. So one of the things we kind of talked about was that solutions may work, interventions may work in one setting. There's potential for these interventions to work in another setting. How can you translate from one setting to another? It isn't just the case of, you know, taking a program, picking it up, and dropping it into another place. That isn't going to be successful. There has to be some information or some process for translating the program to this new setting with this whole new context. And program implementation requires robust data and long-term investment. So if you don't have the data behind you to show what the magnitude of the issue is and how these solutions work, it's very hard to get people interested and invested in what you're doing. And then we have to invest long-term in these solutions. It's not a quick fix. You can't just go in, do a 12-month intervention and then expect to not have to do any follow-up work after that. So significant long-term investment must be made, not just on the part of us as practitioners, but also the donors and the governments, the countries, et cetera. And then finally, violence requires multidisciplinary solutions. So I've kind of been making this point that this, you know, it's not just these silos anymore. It's not these domains that you have to cut across them, look at what's underlying underneath all of these issues. And then one thing we were kind of excited about was this idea of innovative partnerships. And I know that's kind of a buzzword that people use a lot, and it can mean so many different things. But, you know, really bringing in people in communications and in the private sector and, you know, another areas like that, who people who may not think they have an interest in violence prevention until you start to make the case to them that this is everybody's interest, that everyone is affected by this. All of our sectors, all of our work, all of our lives are affected by this, even if you don't personally experience violence. We had a second workshop in April, and I'm just going to briefly cover this one. These were sort of the four main points that came out of this. And as you can see, like, I'm starting to get repetitive because these are some of the same issues that are coming up, and I'm sure you've all heard this as well in your work. In this one, we looked at the social and economic costs of violence, and the idea here was to really explore this idea that it isn't just about perpetrators and victims. This is about everyone else who witnesses violence, who lives in violent communities, or even just sees it happening, whether or not you are yourself directly affected by it. So, you know, it's sort of a no-brainer here. The cost of violence extends beyond the immediate and direct. You have a number of indirect victims as well. the true cost of violence, which, you know, I think is mostly in suffering, pain, and grief, and not necessarily in bodily harm, is really immeasurable. You can't put a dollar value on what violence costs if you're talking about suffering and pain. All sectors are affected by violence. We had a number of speakers come and talk about their sector being affected by violence. And it was really kind of interesting to hear from somebody at the Department of Labor talk about this, Department of Education, et cetera. And then we had a number of people coming from different countries talking about their violence prevention work and how the context really shapes the type of violence, the response to violence, the allocation of resources, et cetera. And then, of course, investing in early prevention is cost-effective. I think that going forward, especially in this economy, is sort of the biggest case to be made, is that violence prevention works and is important because it will save a lot of money down the line. So we have two workshops coming up. One is in December. It's here in D.C. It's also down the street. This is looking at information and communication technology for violence prevention, or kind of what we've dubbed M Prevent Violence. We went back and forth on both of those, which sort of draws from, I don't know if you're familiar with this concept of M Health or M Banking, M Finance, et cetera, kind of drawing from that concept of harnessing and leveraging these communication technologies for the purpose of violence prevention. So like I said earlier, you have these great programs that work in one place. Can you scale them up in some way, maybe being able to use ICTs, information communications technologies, social media, et cetera? And I think everyone's aware of what's been happening in the Middle East for the past year. And social media has played a really huge role in that. And is there some way that that type of power can be harnessed for, you know, a lot of the work that we do? And then the second future workshop is on, I hate the name of this, I will say this, the contagious nature of violence. I'm not a big fan of that terminology, but the concept is sort of looking at, you know, violence, how do you stop the transmission of violence? So if it occurs in one place, how do you prevent it from occurring, you know, sort of spreading out? And you hear this a lot when people talk about suicide clusters, youth violence, et cetera. And I'm sure some of you are familiar with the work of Gary Slotkin in Chicago and his ceasefire program. I think there's a documentary that just come out about that recently. And it's kind of that similar idea that there, you know, if you have a violent act occurring, you can interrupt that transmission in certain ways and what works and what doesn't work. So I'm going to just stop there because I'll let the others talk. Maybe there'll be, I don't know how you want to arrange this, but some questions, I would assume. So here's my contact information. That's our website. Yes, that is our website. So feel free to visit, and I'm happy to talk some more about it. And our workshop in December, I didn't mention the dates. It's December 8th and 9th. There's information on this website. It's free. It's open to the public. We have some really interesting people coming to speak. I actually just heard, like, 20 minutes ago or whenever, just before I started this, that Tom Frieden is interested in attending and giving a discussion or leading a discussion. So I think I'm very excited about that because, I mean, I know the CDC has really sort of led this work forward, but it's really great to have people not in violence prevention and sort of in the broader field of public health understand that there is this really important issue happening and it affects all of us. So on that, I will stop there.